Being an Effective Manager, Task 11, Create a Culture of Change and Innovation. Isaiah 43, 18 through 19, Forget the former things, do not dwell on the past. See, I'm doing a new thing. Now it springs up. Do you not perceive it? I am making a way in the wilderness and streams in the wasteland. God can make new things happen even in the wasteland and the desert. Philippians 3, 12 through 14, Paul says, not that I've already obtained all of this, I've already arrived at my goal, but I press on to take hold of that for which Christ Jesus took hold of me. Brothers and sisters, I do not consider myself yet to have taken hold of it, but one thing I do. What's that one thing? Forgetting what is behind and straining toward what is ahead, I press on toward the goal to win the prize for which God has called me heavenward in Christ Jesus. Paul's focus is on the future, on going forward. Why is that? Why does a manager need to be looking towards the future and dealing with change and innovation? Number one, up until the 1900, it was said that the accumulation of knowledge doubled every century. So every 100 years, knowledge doubles. Two, at the end of World War II, knowledge doubled every 25 years. So every 25 years, knowledge doubles. Today, anywhere from 1 to 1.5 years. Nanotechnology, they say, every 2 years. Clinical knowledge every 18 months. And IBM predicts that in the next couple of years, information will double every 11 hours. So things are changing. The things that we learned yesterday are no longer applicable today. When I went to college, computer science people, I remember they had punch cards. And they would program by punching these cards, and they'd have a stack of cards like this. They'd stick them in the machine, and the machine would sort through them. I mean, it was an incredible amount of effort for very little result, and the machine took up the whole building. Probably my phone has more computer power than those whole old machines. So life is changing quickly. Young people starting out today have bills I never had. I didn't have a phone, a mobile phone bill. I didn't have the internet that I had to do, or cable TV. All these monthly costs that young people have today didn't exist before. In the last century, all the electric appliances and machinery, all these things have all come within the last few hundred years. So life is changing faster and faster and faster and faster. And whatever business you're in, whatever product you're making could be gone in the next several years. Churches still exist. We believe that God is still on the throne, that His Spirit is operating, that will always exist, but that doesn't mean how we operate doesn't change. Language changes. We change our language so that people can understand what we're saying. So there's still change no matter what. So why do people resist change? If change is inevitable, there's nothing we can do to stop the change, but why do people then resist it? Why don't people like it? Number one, there's this perceived loss of security. I have a job, I'm doing this thing, but maybe this thing will not be needed one day, and what will happen to my job? What will happen to my sense of what I do? I already know what I do, I'm really good at what I do, and now what I do is not needed. So there's sort of a financial security, but there's also an emotional security. When we have something that we do and we do it well, we have sort of a security feeling out of that. There's a perceived loss of job competence. A lot of older workers, you know, things are become computerized, and then the company wants to switch over to a new computer system, And the older folk don't feel like they can learn it that quickly, and the younger ones are better at it, and they're faster, and they remember all the little steps, and they feel like their competency is going down. Whereas before, a tradesman would be good at with leather or making things, carpentry, and as he gets older, he just gets better because his knowledge becomes more and more and more. But now, all of a sudden, the whole thing changes, and I have to start all over. Number three, there's the fear of the unknown. What's going to happen? I don't know. How's it going to affect me? How's it going to affect my family? There's the fear of being left behind. Others are going to catch on to this thing, this new technology or this new way of doing it, but I won't be able to catch on. I'm good at what I do now, but I don't know if I can change. There's the loss of current habits that make life less stressful. It's habits. It's the habits in our life that makes life something you can deal with. If you have to learn something new all the time, it's very stressful. The first time you move to a new place and you have to cut your grass. And you go around and you don't have a system yet. And so you don't know if you should go this way and then turn or do this part and turn around or whatever. So the first few times you have to think about the whole thing. And the whole time you're doing it, you're wondering if you should try it a different way. You're experimenting. Well, finally, after a couple of months, you got it figured out. And the next time you do the lawn, you don't even have to think about it. You just automatically do what you did before. Or driving to work, you know, the first time you don't know, I turn left, right, or after a while, your car almost knows exactly where to go. Those habits in our lives make everything less stressful. The new technology comes along. People had watches for many years, and they had little hands. And they just read the hands, and when daylight savings time, you have to turn the clock back, they just wound the hand back. They knew exactly how to do it. I had an elder once who got a digital watch. After having a watch with the hands, he got a digital watch, and then daylight savings happened. You had to turn back an hour, but he had no idea how to do it. He didn't know how to hit mode and then change and then all the things you got to do with a digital watch. He had no idea what to do, so he just left it. So for half the year, his watch was accurate, and for half the year, he had to add an hour or subtract an hour. I remember sitting in a meeting looking at his watch, and it was the wrong time, and I go, well, you know, why don't you change your watch? He said, well, I don't know how. So I said, well, give it to me, and because I knew, you know, digital things always have a mode, and the mode hit a button, and then you got a go button, and the one that adds up or down, and a lot of things work the same. But for a person not used to that technology, it's just very stressful. Everything is hard, everything is difficult until you figure it out. So we lose the habits. We have these habits in our lives. It makes life very easy. And all of a sudden, all these habits get changed. And we have all this stress in our lives. Why do most managers resist change? So change is coming. A manager is sort of in charge of the organization, keeping things running, keeping things rolling, keeping everyone working at their maximum capacity. Why is it that managers, probably more than any, resist change? They're the leaders. I mean, I can see the people wanting to resist the change, but why does a manager want to resist change? In part, it's because of what the manager does. Change leads to chaos. Okay, when things change, you know, all of a sudden the road that you take to work is closed. That leads to chaos. Now what road do I take? What's the best way? I have to figure something else out. I have a mess on my hands, whereas before I could do it automatically without thinking. Change leads to chaos. Managers like order. That's what they do. They take chaos and make it into order. So they don't like things that come in and take their order and change it back into chaos because now they got to fix something. Change messes up plans and goals. Managers like known plans and goals. That's what managers do. They make a plan for the project. They have all these goals. They break it down into the steps. They have people assigned, begin date, completion date, and then something comes in and messes the whole thing out. One change messes up the whole thing. Now you got to go in and redo the whole plan. You had it all figured out. It was all nice. Now the whole thing has to be redone. Change upsets some members of the team. Some people don't like change. Now they're upset. Managers like everyone happy and working hard. We finally figured out what we want to do. We've got our goals. We've got our steps. We've got our assignments. Everyone's happy. Everyone's working hard. And now everything's upset. This person doesn't like the change. Something has come down from the corporate situation, and now everything is upset, and people are upset, and the manager has all this work to do. Number four, change makes the future uncertain, and managers like to manage the future. So there's someone in my church who owns a printing business. They print a lot of books, a lot of Christian books. And recently, one of the biggest Christian bookstores in the United States is filed for bankruptcy. So he just told me last night that there's a lot of publishers that are hurting because this bookstore had a lot of their books on consignment, and now they can't pay for any of them. So a lot of publishers are losing tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars, and printing presses don't know where they're going to be printing, and it's just a whole mess. That one change has affected one business after another, and all the managers of those businesses now have to rethink everything. You know, they were counting on certain orders, and those orders aren't going to be there. They were counting on getting paid, and now they have to write those things off as a loss. So, all of a sudden the manager has a lot of work to do. How can a manager help in the changes? So changes are coming, okay? Changes are coming. You can count on that. So how can a manager, instead of being afraid of all the changes coming, how can he be in the process? Number one, in planning, always leave room for change. Because you're going to plan, you have your calendar, you have your schedule, you have all the goals, you have the steps, you have assignments to different people. Don't figure out your calendar so tight that one mistake is going to upset the whole thing, or you're going to always be redoing it every day. So you have to figure that there's going to be problems. Leave room for some of the changes that you can't anticipate. Anticipate and prepare for change. What changes can you anticipate coming? I mean, you have to look into the future and go, what are we really good? What's happening? I mean, as a leader in church, I need to be thinking, you know, people and their schedules, how's this going to work? Is Sunday morning going to be the best time for everyone to come and worship? How are we going to do this? How do you have a small group for people that are in their 20s, that are busy going to school? You know, maybe we need a whole different way of communicating to them. Number three, see change as perhaps a new opportunity to succeed. So maybe something different is coming down the pike. How can that different thing sort of help us? How can we use this change? For example, it used to be, you know, we had at least in the United States, we had these one-room schoolhouses. They were a small little school, and all the grades would be in one class. And so each grade would have to help out the other. And now we've moved towards, you know, one grade for one classroom for every grade, one age group. And our whole society has sort of moved in that direction, that like people get put together. We live in a very special interest-driven society. We have a magazine for every special interest that there is. There's an online community for whatever you're into. If you're into old cars, there's a whole group of people that are into old cars. If you're into sewing, there's sewing. If you're into this specialized quilting, you can be in this specialized group. Whatever your interest is, no matter what the topic is, there's a whole group of people doing that. You can find the group that likes exactly what you like. So we live in a culture filled with that. So what's happening is families being separated from one another to go to their special interest. So dads are going over here, moms are going over there. Each kid has their own special interest, their own special group. When the family gets into a car, everyone has their own music. They're listening to their iPod or whatever their listening device is. Everyone has their own genre of music they listen to. It used to be there was only one radio in the home and everyone listened to the same thing. Now everyone does their own thing. So people are being separated from the family. The family isn't the thing that holds people together. It's the special interest that's holding them together. So the church often will then just follow what society is doing. So when you go to church, the dads go over here, the moms have their special thing, the kids all go to the class that they belong to, and everyone goes to whatever their interest is. So we just follow. That's a change that has happened. Okay. So in one way, that's a negative thing, or we can see this as an opportunity. See, the whole culture is separating the family. Why don't we be the organization that helps bring the family back together? Because no one's doing that. I mean, what an opportunity. I mean, instead of bemoaning the culture we live in, oh, we live in a culture that's destroying the family, as a church, we could say, wow, no one is trying to help dads and sons do something together. So if we just plan something where dads and sons do something together, we will have no competition. We'll be the only ones doing it. What an opportunity for the church. So sometimes the change just leaves a hole, leaves a need that your organization can try to fill. Number four. Help the people you manage do 1 through 3. So not only in your plans and goals do you leave room for change, but you help all the people you're helping do the same thing. Number five, give people time to change. My wife, my oldest son, the minute I suggest something, they're dead set against it. No matter what it is, no matter what I suggest, they are dead set against it because their minds take time to assimilate whatever it is I'm suggesting. Okay, it's a change. They like things in order. They like things planned, and they have their sense of what this week or this month or this year or their life is going to be. And I suggest something, and they can't assimilate it. It takes them a while. Now, some people are very quick. They hear something new and boom, they can assimilate right into their life. I'm more that way. I like the change. Oh, that's cool. I'm going to make that work. But others need to hear it, not just once. They're against it. Doesn't mean they're against it. So then you say it again and you say it again, and then they list their objections, and then you have to meet all their objections. So if you're leading a church and you want to change something, it takes a long time for people to come around. My first church, we just wanted to change the worship time a half an hour. And you would have think that I started World War III because people were threatened by it. They came up with all kinds of reasons why this isn't going to work. But it just took time. People need time to get used to the ideas and the change around them. How to create a culture of innovation. Number one, brainstorming sessions on problems. Okay? So change is really just another problem. So society is changing. What do we do about this problem? So instead of bringing the new idea, just bring the problem. And now we have to solve the problem. Brainstorming sessions just for fun. Get the people that you're leading and working with, get them used to this idea of brainstorming, thinking about things. It doesn't hurt to think about things. You can do it just for fun. How can we make sermons more interesting? So we're going to brainstorm that. So we put that on the whiteboard, and we think about sermons being interesting. Okay, I get up and I just speak, and I speak out of the Bible. How can we make that interesting? Well, we can have someone drawing. You know, I'm talking about something, and they can actually draw whatever I'm saying on a whiteboard behind me. Now, we've done that. It's very interesting. Or maybe we could have some video going behind. Or would that be distracting? I don't know. We're just brainstorming, thinking about ways to do this. Maybe you could have a team of people give the sermon. Or maybe you could just get up and instead of saying anything, just stand at the pulpit like this. And then everything you want to say is just on the PowerPoint. And the PowerPoint automatically is just going and people have to read along. And after about 2 minutes, they're wondering, you know, what's going on? And you just let it go. I don't know if that's a good idea, but we're just having fun. We're just, you know, seeing what we can do. So brainstorm, you know, get people thinking outside the box. It doesn't mean you're going to do these things. Help, you know, think of the absurd, think of the crazy thing, just to get used to change, you know. Probably we're not going to do any of these things, but get used to the change. Number three, reward innovation. Honor the people that come up with a different way of doing it. I was doing the renovation last night, and we were doing some drywall. I don't know if you've ever done drywall, but drywall is extremely heavy. And as we're doing this and putting this in, and I had to go get some new sheets. They were 12 feet by 4 feet. They're half inch thick, and they were heavier than all get out. And I said, you know, if I was in a drywall, I would think of a different way of doing this. I mean, why can't we have like plastic drywall? It's just light plastic, and we stick it up, we pound it in, and then we inject it with something heavy or something. And all the drywall people were like, that's the craziest, what's wrong with the way it is? They were like, this is how we do it, we're used to it. And they were threatened by my crazy idea. I mean, maybe it is a crazy idea, but they were like totally dead set against doing anything different than what we're already doing. Reward innovation. Reward people thinking of different ways, even if the ideas aren't that good. So reward ideas. Reward attempts. You know, you tried something, it didn't work. But you know what? At least you tried something. Reward successes. Somebody I mentioned, I think, in one of the earlier sessions that I have a Bible business that I print like 50,000 New Testaments without covers, and then I put, you know, a ministry's cover on, you know, whatever ministry that exists, NASCAR people, cowboy people, whatever. And someone was really interested in the King James Bible, and I like the King James, but to use the King James New Testament as an outreach Bible, I mean, a person who's never read the Bible in their life, they open up the King James Bible, and it's got words you have no idea. You have no idea what it's saying. The King James is a wall of words because there's no chapter headings in the King James. And there's no quotation marks in the King James. So you don't know when someone's speaking and when they're not speaking. You know, Jesus said, but there's no quotation marks. So it's you know, the format is really hard to read. Some of the words are hard to understand. But there was a ministry that really wanted the King James Bible. So I sat down and I looked at the King James Bible. It is kind of cool. I like the archaic way of saying things and so on. I grew up with it myself. So I took the King James, the original King James, 400 years ago, King James, the old Bible. And what I did is I added quotation marks. I just went through and added quotation marks where someone's speaking. That's a quotation mark. Then I just added the chapter headings. Now, the King James Bible is still there. It's still literally the King James Bible, but I added quotation marks. And I added chapter headings. They're not part of the Bible, per se. They're just like study helps along the way. And then I took all the archaic words, the words that we have no idea today what they mean, and I just put in parentheses what they mean. So this is the Bible that I finally made. It's called a Cowboy Bible, Wild Horse Ministries. And this ministry, the guy here, kind of taming a horse, he'll go to a fair and he'll have 200 people watching. He has this made-up fence thing, and he'll train a horse. Take a horse that's never been ridden, and he'll calm him down and show him how to train a horse in 2 hours. And the whole time, he's using it as a metaphor for sharing the gospel. So he'll say something like, you see how this horse is running away from me? And that's what we do too sometimes. We run away from God. God wants to help us, and we're fearful, and so we run away. And so he has this whole thing that he does. At the end, he gives away the King James Bible, but at least now people have a shot at understanding what it means. So I took a problem, saw the problem, and instead of just doing nothing with it, I tried to think of, well, how can we work with this? How can we change this and do something innovative that will help someone actually succeed with it? So as a manager, it's not just about getting things organized and done well. Many companies will be organized and well running, and they'll be well running right into the ground because they're managed well, they do everything well, but the product and the service that they provide does not meet a need anymore. The needs have changed. So you have to be willing to see the needs and to adjust what you're doing to meet the needs. It doesn't mean, like in the Christian world, that we compromise on the gospel. The gospel can speak to anyone, but it has to speak in the people's language.